Welcome back to Hell on Hills podcast. I'm Amanda.
Hi, James. Hi, husband.
So Bryce isn't here with us. She's here in spirit. She said to let you all know that mom life hit her really hard, but she's going to be back for this episode. And no, she's not. I'm sorry. That's a lie. She's going to be back for the next episode. For this episode, you get James.
Am I supposed to say something?
Yeah, this is the banter part.
We banter enough at dinner.
Yeah, but this is for the people.
I don't know what to say.
You can just talk about how thrilled and honored you are to be here.
I am thrilled and honored to be here.
Sorry, we sprung this on poor James, 2 hours ago? Something like that? So it's...
Maybe three, but I was at work.
Yeah, it was very last minute, but he's great, and he's here. And he's got a story for us today, too, but... first, we have some socials, and Bryce usually does this, so forgive me if I get it wrong, or don't. I don't care. But you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Hell on Hills Podcast. We're on X, formerly Twitter, at Hell on Hills Pod. You can send us an email at hellonhillspodcast@gmail.com. And finally, you can join us on Discord as well. And you can find all of these links on our link tree, or literally probably if you just Google it. Like, we'll come up. Hell on Hills Podcast.
Okay, hi friends. Jumping in really quick, it's Bryce, if you guys couldn't tell. I will explain more on the next episode about what's going on. Nothing negative, just kind of a crazy life right now. But I do want to just say thank you so much, James, Amanda, for stepping in and getting an episode together. I know it was very rushed to get James in and helping, so I very much appreciate all the help he's given us. So I just want to say I will be back. I know Amanda says a couple times she doesn't know, but she does know. And I will be back on the next episode. We'll talk more about what happened in the whole week and all of that fun stuff. But again, thank you, James, for stepping in and helping with everything this week.
And I think we're just going to jump right into it today. You just want to go right into the story?
I thought you were going first.
Oh, yeah, I'm going first, but... do you want me to just jump right into it? Do you want to talk about work? Do you want to tell them anything about work?
No.
Okay. So we're just going to jump right into it then. All right, guys. For those who hate banter, this is your podcast this time. So James, I think he's in for the paranormal. Like, you like that kind of stuff, yeah?
It depends on what it is, but sure.
But the true crime is not as much of a forte.
I don't know if that's true. I'm the one who gave you the Tarkov killer story.
True. That is true. Okay, so both of them are kind of... you're interested, but the interest doesn't go as deep as bright enough.
But not enough to start a podcast, no.
Okay, fair. So have you, by chance, ever heard of Mara Murray?
Mara Murray?
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I have.
So she's pretty... this case is pretty well known. It is unsolved. Sorry, guys. But some people call her, like, the beginning of true crime. Or, like, she was around that time. And her story's been covered, oh my gosh, for so many times, countless times. It's very frustrating. Hopefully one day we'll get answers, but if I'm being honest, it's not looking good. A woman called police at 7:27 p.m. on February 9th, 2004. She was in her home in Woodsville, New Hampshire, when she heard a loud thump, and when she looked out the window, she saw a car in a snowbank. So she called the Grafton County Sheriff's Department and reported a car accident on a sharp corner near her home.
As so normal occurrence in New Hampshire.
I feel like it is, right? It's February. It's snowing. Like, that feels pretty normal to find a car in a snowbank. So she calls in. The 911 log states the woman claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette inside the car. However, the woman refutes this, and she claims that she saw a red light glowing inside the car, and she described it to be kind of like a light from a cell phone.
What year was this?
2004.
So, I guess early flip phone light, like she, what Nokias had red lights?
I don't know. Let's see, in 2004, I would have been like a freshman, so I'm thinking like maybe a Razor, the original Razor, something around there.
I feel like, I don't know, I was behind the curve on cell phones in school. 2004 would have been my sophomore year. We still had those bricks, the Nokia bricks with Snake.
I promise you, I probably still have that phone at Mama's and Daddy's. That thing never dies. And Snake was the best game of all time ever. But it was some kind of probably antique phone with a red light. Or at least that's what she thought. A school bus driver who lived nearby, he was passing when he stopped to check on the car. And he told police that there was a young woman walking around the vehicle. And he stated that she wasn't bleeding. She didn't seem injured. But she was cold and shivering. And so this guy offered to call for assistance, and she declined. He specifically said that she asked him not to call police, and that she had already called AAA.
What's the school bus driver doing out this late?
I don't know. Football game? Baseball game? Basketball? Isn't basketball around in...
Well, if it was for sports related, wouldn't he have students with him?
No, but he'd have to drop them off and then take the bus home. Or then go home.
I guess so.
Oh, so yeah, he asks if she need help. She's like, no, please don't call police. I've already called AAA. So the man goes home and he called police. He said that he knew there was no cell service in the area, and his call was logged at the police station at 7:43 p.m. There was one final witness. Another woman who lived in the area claimed to have been driving home from work, and she passed the accident at 7:37 p.m. When she passed, she said that a police SUV was parked facing Mara's car, so like hood to hood. And she said the woman pulled over for a second, but she didn't see anybody inside or outside of either one of the vehicles, so she just went home.
So this woman saw the vehicle 5 minutes before the other guy, the bus driver's call was logged?
Right. So presumably after the bus driver left, but, and we'll get into it here, but before the police arrived. There was a report that between 8 and 8:30 p.m., a contractor was on his way home when he passed a young person quickly moving eastbound on Route 112. And Route 112 is the route that Mara Murray's car was found on. It's the route that she was presumed to have been traveling. This pedestrian was on foot. They were wearing a dark coat, a light colored hood, and jeans. And this guy didn't report this to police until months later because he noticed it and he heard about the case, but he didn't realize the date until he was going over his records for work.
So he just didn't report what he saw at all?
He did, but it was, like I said, it was months later after he got on, after he was, I guess, like reconciling or whatever his records. And he heard about the Mara Murray case. And that's when he was like, oh shit, that was this day. So he did eventually call police. According to official police logs, a Haverhill police officer arrived at the scene of Mara Murray's car at 7:46 p.m. The driver of the car had disappeared, and the car was locked. When he looked at the car, it said that, or like in his report, he wrote that the car had collided with the tree on the front driver's side. The left headlight was severely damaged. The car's radiator had been pushed into the fan, and the windshield was cracked, and both airbags had been deployed. So the car was inoperable. They found red stains inside and outside the car, but it didn't look like blood. It was actually wine. Inside the car, they found an empty beer bottle, a damaged box of Franzia wine on the back seat, a AAA card, blank accident report forms, gloves, CDs, makeup, diamond jewelry. There were directions, and babe, you'll remember this, there were MapQuest directions to Burlington, Vermont.
Don't insult me like that.
Okay, well, I know if I remember it, you're going to remember it. You're only a year older. And I wasn't wrong. So, they also found a stuffed animal and a book titled Not Without Peril. And this is a book about mountain climbing in the White Mountains. And some sources also stated that her school books were found in the car as well. Police found no footprints in the snow. And they traced the license plate to 21-year-old Mara Murray. Now, Mara Murray, she was born May 4th, 1982, in Brockton, Massachusetts. She was the fourth child of Fred and Laura Murray. She had an older brother named Fred, two older sisters named Kathleen and Julie, and one younger half-brother, Kurt. Her parents divorced when she was just six, and Mara lived with her mother. She graduated from Whitman Hanson Regional High School in Hanson, Massachusetts, where she was a star athlete on the tracks team. After high school, she attended West Point Academy in New York, and she studied chemical engineering there for three semesters. She transferred to the University of Massachusetts Amherst to study nursing there after she decided West Point just wasn't a good fit for her. It was said that she was kind of following in one of her older sister's footsteps and just felt like it wasn't for her. At the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Mara was on the dean's list. And sources kind of varied here. I found sources of her friends that described her as highly motivated, very conscientious. She could be shy, but she was free-spirited. She loved the outdoors, specifically hiking. While she lived with her mom growing up, she was still close with her dad, Fred, and they would go camping and hiking together often, usually in the New Hampshire mountains. Mara was on the tracks team. She loved running. And I mentioned that she was on the track team in high school. She broke her high school record for the 2-mile run twice.
But so you said something about varying reports, and then just are you getting to what varied or?
Yes. Thank you for keeping me on track. So it was clear she loved running. That was, everybody said that. There was no question there. Some reports said that after she left West Point and started at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, some sources said that she wasn't really adjusting well. She was very secluded and was having trouble fitting in with the other students, which is just, it's notable. She was in a long-distance relationship with her boyfriend, Billy Rausch. They had met at West Point, and they started dating in the fall of 2001. They would travel to each other's school to spend time with each other when they could, and Laura had actually arranged for a summer job at a hospital in Oklahoma to be closer to Billy. And Billy would later tell the media they were engaged to be engaged, and Maura's father, Fred, said that these two would have ended up married. without a doubt.
Feels like a line. Engaged to be engaged. Like, do you write that for TV?
I mean, it does feel like a line. I have to agree with you, but I mean, I get it. Weren't we engaged to be engaged?
I don't remember ever calling it anything like that.
I didn't ask if we called it that, but we were.
I guess. I don't know. I guess I wasn't also, you know, doing interviews with, you know, local news stations about you either.
Why not?
Oh my God.
In November of... Did you have something else to add?
No.
In November of 2003, Mora admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food from multiple restaurants. The charge was to be dismissed after 3 months of good behavior. February 5th, 2004, Mora was on duty at her campus security job. And she worked at a desk checking student IDs as they entered the dorm.
Wait, so that wasn't identity theft? Like, what were the official charges? Or was it just fraud, or?
I couldn't find the official charges, but it was basically like it was in continuance and 3 months of good behavior. So in continuance, in a legal form, this is not an exact definition, so forgive me. But it sounded kind of like her trial was like postponed. And then if she stayed on good behavior for 3 months, they would throw it out. Assumingly because she admitted to it. She didn't try to hide it.
Okay, so no official charges, but basically identity theft and or fraud, and then she gets a job checking people's identities.
Yes.
Interesting.
Fair point. Fair point, okay. But yes, so that was her job, checking people's identities. And there was kind of a lull in, I guess, in the influx of students. But there was a lull in the night, so she made a phone call to her older sister, Kathleen. It was around 10 p.m. And according to her sister, they discussed Kathleen's relationship issues with her fiancé. The two of them had been fighting recently. And Kathleen says this is just a normal conversation. Like, they talked regularly about the day-to-day type things, just keeping in touch. They were pretty close. In October of 2017, Kathleen went into more detail about this phone call. And she said that she had recently been discharged from a rehab for alcoholism around this time. And on the way home, her fiancé took her to a liquor store, which had caused her to relapse. So that was the conversation that she had with Mara.
So, wait, Mara was in rehab or her sister?
Her sister, Kathleen, was in rehab and had relapsed. And that was what the phone call to Mara was talking about.
Gotcha. Which is, right, so, like, that's the importance of discussing the wine earlier in the car, possibly?
Possibly. I feel like it's more important to note because at the time, Kathleen told police that she had no idea why Mora would be seen crying after their phone call. She did say that it wasn't, especially because it's not like her to cry. But I feel like I have personal experience with people suffering from alcoholism. I feel like that could be triggering, especially to someone who may already be going through a lot.
Okay, I guess I could see that. Like, if her and her sister are really close and then she relapsed and she was invested in her recovery.
Right, yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. It was reported that Mara was seen crying later that night while still on shift. And her supervisor would just kind of make the rounds. And when her supervisor got to Mara's desk, she found her completely zoned out and unresponsive, and she was said not to react to her supervisor's presence at all. After escorting her back to her dorm room around 1:20 a.m., her supervisor asked Mora what was wrong, and Mora's only response was "my sister." February 7th, 2004. This is 2 days after this this episode. Fred Murray had arrived in Amherst to take his daughter car shopping. And according to Fred, he and Maura went car shopping that afternoon. And they were shopping for Maura's a new car because she had like an old model Saturn. And it was just on its last leg. I think he said it was running on three cylinders. Don't quote me on that because I'm not a car person, but I believe that's what I read.
Yeah, that would be bad. If it's a four-cylinder engine and one of the cylinders is failing, that would be an engine thing.
That's what it sounded like. Thank you. But it was noted that Maura was trying to drive it as little as possible until they were able to get her new car. And Fred had said, like, she would have had a new car by the next week. They had already picked one out and everything. After they went car shopping, they went to dinner with a friend of Mara's. And then that night after dinner, Maura wanted to go to a party. So she dropped her dad off at his hotel room and she borrowed his Toyota Corolla. She went to a party on campus at 10:30 that night. And according to friends at this party, Maura was drinking. She wasn't like overboard, but she had definitely been drinking. And she seemed dead set on taking the car back to her dad. And her friends were trying to talk her out of it and telling her, like, he's not expecting the car back until tomorrow anyway. Just wait it out. You don't have to drive tonight. And when she left, they were under the understanding that Maura was going back to her dorm. At 2:30 a.m. Sunday morning, she left that party and she headed back to her dad's hotel room. That night, she hit a guardrail at about 3:30 a.m., and this caused about $8,000 to $10,000 worth of damage, because sources did vary on that as well, to the car. And the responding officer wrote an accident report, but there was no mention of a field sobriety test being performed. Maura was taken back to her dad's hotel room, and she stayed there for the night. And her dad said that she was shaken up and apologetic. But he said, and this is a quote, "If this is the only trouble a kid ever causes, then you're a pretty lucky parent."
If drunk driving is the only trouble that a kid ever causes?
It was unclear on if he knew she was drunk or not. And, I mean, this was an hour later that she got into the accident. I don't know how much she had to drink.
I mean, her friends were trying to persuade her not to drive back to her dad's hotel. I don't know. Maybe not a quote worth going over, I guess. I don't know. Just seems like he must not have known that she was drinking, because if I knew she was drinking and I was her parent, I would be pretty fucking pissed.
Oh, agreed. Like, you can have one drink and you can just call me. Like, I'll come get you, you know, stay there, whatever. And this hotel room was, like, a pretty healthy distance away from the place too. So she could have been drunk. She could have been tired. It's 3:30 in the morning. So I agree with you on that. At 4:49 a.m., she called her boyfriend Billy, and we don't know what was said on this call, but we know it was made. Later that Sunday, Fred was told that his insurance would cover the damages to his vehicle. So he rented a car, he dropped Maura back off at school, and then he left to go back home to Connecticut. He last talked to Maura at about 11:30 that night, and he reminded her to get an accident report from the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles. I'm assuming his insurance would probably want that. And then he agreed to talk again Monday night with her to discuss those forms and the insurance claim in more detail. The next info that we have: after midnight on Monday, Maura used MapQuest, and she got directions to the Berkshires. Is it Berkshires or Berkshires? It's Berkshires, right?
Berkshires.
Okay.
I don't know. It depends. Like, I don't know. Some northern accent might be different, but I'm pretty sure it's like the English pronunciation, so Berkshire.
Okay. That's what I thought. So I'm going to say Berkshire, because this is my story. And then she also got directions to Burlington, Vermont. On Monday, February 9th at 1 p.m., She emailed her boyfriend, Billy, and she said, that email says, "I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I didn't feel like talking too much of anyone. I promise to call you today, though. Love you, Maura."
What a weird way to address somebody. No one ever called me stud in the mid-2000s.
I mean, I don't know. I wasn't 21 in the mid-2000s either.
I guess it's fair. Still, 16. Stud that just didn't cross my mind as part of the vernacular for teenagers at the time.
Well, I mean, if they met in West Point, was it their vernacular for young military people?
Maybe, but I mean, that's where I grew up as a teenager, was on military bases, so I don't know. I never really ever heard the word stud in that. I get it. I understand it as a term of endearment, but I don't know. I've never heard anyone actually refer to someone else as a stud as a term of endearment outside of, like, I don't know, dudes complimenting each other for sports.
I was literally about to say, like, to me, it sounds like something a guy would tell his best, deepest guy friends. She also made a phone call to a condominium in Bartlett, New Hampshire. And this is a condo association that her family had vacationed at in the past, and records indicate that this call lasted for 3 minutes. According to the association, Maura did not rent the condo. And from what the woman, when she was spoken to, from what she said, it would have been impossible because they book that condo like months and months in advance. It's not like, hey, can I call, you know, on Monday and come rent it this weekend. They just didn't operate like that.
So based on the phone calls and the messages that she sent, was it fair to assume that maybe she was just trying to make like a weekend getaway or something?
That's what a lot of people think. Like, because there's obviously a lot going on in her life with the with her stealing the credit card and breaking down crying at work, her sister going through these troubles. A lot of people speculate like she might have just wanted to get away for the weekend. At 1:13 p.m., and this is still on Monday, she called a fellow nursing student, and we don't know what this call entailed either. She had an aunt that claimed Maura could have just been like borrowing scrubs and returning them, but it's unclear of where that information come from. I couldn't get any credible source that stated, hey, this is what happened on that phone call.
It doesn't seem to add up with where her mindset might have been if she was like planning a getaway, like, unless maybe it just crossed her mind somewhere, like, oh, I have some scrubs that I need to return before I leave.
Right. To me, that feels like something you would do if you're not coming back.
Well, I mean, not necessarily. If you know you're going to be gone for a few days and, like, you have a nursing student that you borrowed scrubs from and, you know they're going to be at class and you're not. And you don't want to hold it up for a few days.
I mean, I guess, but if it's just a weekend... I mean, I also know the rest of the story, too, so let me keep reading. Sorry. At 1:24 p.m., Maura emailed the nursing department to let them know that she'd be out of town for a week due to a death in the family, and she would let them know when she got back. According to her family, there was no death. At 2:05 p.m., she called a number that gave pre-recorded information about hotels in Stowe, Vermont, and this phone call lasted about 5 minutes. At 2:18, she called Billy again, and she left a voicemail promising that they would talk later, and this call lasted for about 1 minute. Now, according to multiple sources, Maura packed a bag containing clothing, toiletries, her textbooks, and her birth control pills, and she packed that into her car. At some point between Monday and Sunday, she also packed her belongings from her dorm into boxes And this included removing art from the wall and packing it up in a box.
Okay, so that definitely sounds like more than a vacation.
Right, yeah, that was really weird. And she didn't take the boxes with her. They were still in her dorm room, but that's still strange.
That is weird. Like, so she packed up like she was leaving, but then left her stuff.
Right, yeah. She left campus that day at about 3:30 p.m., and classes this day had been canceled due to a snowstorm. She withdrew $280 from an ATM, and then she bought about $40 worth of alcohol from a nearby liquor store. And this included a box of Franzia, Bailey's Irish Cream, a bottle of Kahlua, and a bottle of vodka.
Crazy how $40 went so much further even just in 2004.
Thank you so much, because I was literally thinking that when I was reading off the list of alcohol. I was like, she got all that for $40?
Yeah, it's like one bottle of rum right now.
Yeah, that's like the bottle of Kahlua. Maura also picked up the accident report forms, and she left Amherst between 4 and 5 p.m.
Okay, so wait, that makes it all even weirder. If she packed up her stuff like she was leaving, but didn't take her dorm stuff, it's like mixed signals all over the place, because if she picked up the paperwork, that why would you do that if you didn't intend to actually give it to her dad?
And see, that's like one of the most in my opinion, and probably a bunch of other people's opinions, that is one of the most frustrating things about this case, because it does feel like she's all over the place. As far as we... Police believe that she traveled Interstate 91 north, and the last use of her cell phone was at 4:37 p.m. to check her voicemail. And her cell phone was never found, so this is going off of the phone record. So nobody knew where she was going. There was no definitive trace of where she was going. And a lot of people didn't even know she was going anywhere. The school, they knew because she said she, you know, there was a death. She needed to leave for a week. But her family didn't know she was leaving. She didn't tell anybody. And police have also never found Maura's debit card, her credit cards, or, like I mentioned, her cell phone. And the multiple bottles of liquor that she had bought were also not in the car. So those were gone as well. The responding officer and the bus driver, they drove around the area looking for Maura. And around 8 p.m., EMS and a fire truck arrived to clear the scene. And Mara's car was towed to a local garage by 9 p.m. that night. They did find a rag that seemed to be from the emergency kit of the car stuffed into the car's tailpipe. Police would list... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I don't really have anything to say about that. I don't really understand why you would stuff a rag in the tailpipe.
I don't either. The only thing I could come up with in my head is the bus driver said, like, she looked cold and she was shivering. Maybe she put it in the tailpipe because it was warm and she was going to wrap it around her hands. That's the only thing I could come up with.
That. Sure. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, I was trying to think of a reason. I can't think of any other reason other than that.
Even if she was like, okay, so hypothetically attacked by somebody, what good would that do? Like, you're not redirecting the fumes anywhere. You can't trap carbon monoxide in a rag to use it like some kind of pseudo chloroform. The most you would do, especially, this is her Mercury, right? The one that was running on three cylinders?
Saturn, but yeah.
Saturn, yeah. Okay, so if it's a Saturn running on three cylinders, there's probably a lot of soot in the tailpipe from incomplete burn from her engine, but like, why would you be wiping out your tailpipe at that point in time? Or if it was an attacker, what would they gain from doing that themselves? I don't know. That's so weird.
That's why the only thing I could come up with was like using the heat to warm her hands. I really don't know either. But police, like, they didn't find any footprints around the car. They didn't find any sign of struggle other than the wine being everywhere. But that presumably could have happened when she crashed.
So if there was no footprints, were there, presumably there were tire tracks.
Nothing.
Well, there had to have been some kind of tire tracks because the bus driver and then, but then there was the lady said that she saw a cop car hood to hood with the Saturn.
Yeah, I found that interesting too, because from the timeline, and let me get back up there. So the timeline says that police arrived on scene at 7:46. The bus driver called police at 7:43, but the woman that passed and claimed to see the SUV, like, hood to hood, she saw that at 7:37. So within minutes, the car that was allegedly there was gone, along with Maura. And I found it interesting that the woman, the witness, called it a police car, too, because why else would Maura, like, lock up her car and take her, you know, cell phone, debit cards, driver's license, whatever.
And liquor.
And liquor, yeah. Why else would she lock everything up? And which I guess maybe she would do that if it was just any old person picking her up and giving her a ride, but I don't know. There was no mention of tire tracks or marks, but also if it's in the middle of a snowstorm, I mean, how long does it take a snowstorm in, where the heck are we? Massachusetts?
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Yeah, I should know that. How long does it take to cover that up, a snowstorm in New Hampshire?
I don't know. It's weird. You'd figure you'd see the evidence of another car pulling up hood to hood with it, though, even if there was in the middle of a snowstorm.
Well, her dad has his own feelings on that, and I'm about to touch on that too. So the police would list Maura as missing at 12 p.m. the next day, roughly 24 hours after she was last seen.
Why did it take them so long to declare her missing?
I'm so glad you asked. So there is a ton of animosity between the family and the police on how this case was investigated. Specifically, police left a voicemail, Police issued a be on the lookout for Maura at 12:36, February 10th. And they reported this person as wearing a dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. Police left a voicemail on Fred's phone at 3:20 p.m., letting him know that they had found her car abandoned.
So they put the bolo out first and then called them 3 hours later?
Yep. The day after they towed the car.
Well, so they had information on the car. They knew who it belonged to.
Yeah, they ran the tags and found that it belonged to her.
And they didn't notify the family. So that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why wouldn't you notify the family if it was even just for them to follow up on it? Like, why wouldn't they get in touch with the family and be like, hey, your daughter's car, we found it. Do you know anything about that? Was she in a wreck or something? Do you know anything?
Right. Like, she's supposed to be in Massachusetts. Hey, we found her car in New Hampshire. Something. Anything, honestly. Like, and even then, like, to find the wine all over the place, I don't know. So they called and left him a voicemail at about 3:20. After one of his other daughters got in touch with him by his cell phone and let him know the situation, that's when Fred called police. And I understand this is still back in the day of, like, you know, home phones weren't a thing of the past yet. And Fred was said to be out of town working, so he wouldn't be able to check his voicemail. So assumably the cops called somebody else in the family. And as soon as he heard from his daughter, he called police. And he was told, if she wasn't reported safe by the next morning, the police would start a search.
But... what?
Uh-huh.
What kind of policy is that? That doesn't make any fucking sense. They already waited almost 24 hours.
Unfortunately, that happens a lot. The weirdest part about it is I have always heard, oh, this isn't a missing person, but you have to wait 24 hours. You have to wait 48 hours.
No,
but
that's a myth.
Well, it was a thing. It was unfortunately more common. But that was like back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Like not in 2004.
No, not when their cell phones exist and information was a little quicker.
Right. And like to me, even if police are like, well, you know, she's a 21-year-old girl. She just, you know, she might just not want to be there.
Her vehicle is involved in a crash. What the fuck do you mean? Obviously, she's not fucking safe.
Exactly. That's my problem. Like, if she just went missing from school or something, like, we can't find her. Okay, I'm still upset about this, but, like, fine. She's a grown person. If she wants to go away for the weekend, she can. But like you said, you found her car inoperable in a snowbank. And within, what, 10 minutes, you respond and she's gone? 15, 20 minutes? 20? I think it was like 20-something minutes from the first phone call.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe they assumed that she ran because there was alcohol in the car. And if they pulled up her liars, they probably would have saw that she was recently involved in a accident. Maybe. I don't know. It still seems weird to just brush it off casually like, oh, she's probably fine.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Let's see. So Maura Murray wasn't officially referred to as a missing person until 5:17 p.m. on February 10th. And just as a reminder, this car accident, well, not the accident. Police were originally called in reference to the accident at 7:27 p.m. on February 9th.
So not quite 24 hours.
Yeah. It sounds like maybe after talking to Fred, police were like, okay, maybe this is, you know, maybe this is a missing person. And they would speak with, they spoke with Maura's family members. They spoke with Billy and Billy's family as well. And it was stated on the evening of February 11th, Maura was believed to have either ran away or committed suicide.
Well, okay, so, like, ran away seems more likely than suicide based on the information. I don't know if they had all the same information that we have right now, but...
yeah, that's a good point. That's one thing that I always struggle with, because obviously I do the research, and this is 21 years after the fact now, so... but I just still struggle, like, to... why would you think she committed suicide? If her stuff is gone, the car is locked, what led you to suicide?
If she picked up the police report, that's my biggest thing, is she picked up something that required future planning.
Yeah, she brought her school books with her. What are you going to do, homework on your way to commit suicide? That doesn't, none of that makes sense to me, but I wasn't there, so, and I'm also sure that there's parts of this case that have not been released to the public. There always are. So maybe they know something that we don't that led them to that conclusion. But
I don't know. To me, based on the information that you presented so far, it seemed like she wanted to quit school. She wanted to quit school, get away for the weekend, but she picked up the police report. She was returning the scrubs because she was going to quit school. She's packing up her dorm because she was going to quit school. She picked up the police report because she was planning on seeing her dad. So to me, it sounded like she was wanted to quit school and go take a quick vacation before breaking the news to her parents that she was quitting.
That is a good point. I do like that theory that you have. I can see that. It also kind of makes me wonder, though, because she just, and to, I guess, kind of play devil's advocate, her getting that job at the hospital in Oklahoma was pretty recent, too. So for her to be quitting school, but still getting a job doing what she was doing, I think maybe she just needed time away. Like, even if she wasn't going to quit, maybe she just wanted to, you know, take a year off or something.
Yeah, maybe.
But either way, her police stating that she either ran away or committed suicide, her family maintains to this day, neither of those things are an option.
They believe in abduction, don't they?
They believe she was met with foul play, yes. So, days later, police stated Murray might be headed to the, I didn't Google this, the Pankamagus. I'm sorry, highway area. They claimed that she was endangered and possibly suicidal. And the police report also claimed Mara was intoxicated at the crash site. And if you remember, the bus driver said that she seemed sober. She seemed sober. She didn't seem hurt. She seemed cold. That was it. And I also find it curious that the police report claims she was intoxicated, but the police never saw her.
Yeah, how could they possibly know that?
Unless they're judging by the wine. But again, you have a box of wine in a car and you got into an accident.
Yeah, it's shitty police work. You can't claim that they're intoxicated and you don't have like a blood alcohol level or a sobriety test or anything like that. Not even a visual test, because like you said, they didn't even fucking see her.
Right. Her family and boyfriend, they also searched for her because her father maintained the police, and I quote, couldn't catch a cold.
I mean, I'm inclined to believe him at this point.
Her family, and when I say family, it's her family and her boyfriend, Billy. They searched all the way to Vermont. They did everything they possibly could and more, honest, in my opinion. 10 days after the investigation started, the FBI got involved, taking this case nationwide. New Hampshire Fish and Game conducted another search using tracking dogs, cadaver dogs, thermal imaging cameras.
Wait, why did the FBI get involved?
I couldn't find a definitive answer on why. It could be that, you know, maybe her family kicked up a fuss. It could be that the police asked them for help. It could possibly be that, you know, she goes to school in Massachusetts and her stuff was found missing, or I'm sorry, her car was found in New Hampshire. So it could be like, you know, a state lines thing.
Yeah, even still, I thought, I mean, yeah, maybe it is a jurisdictional thing, maybe. And they were like the intermediary between state jurisdictions or county jurisdictions or whatever, but like I don't know, it's still weird to me. Like, what does this have to do with the federal government?
Sorry, I was looking up that specifically, and it doesn't really say. It all it says is that they got involved. It doesn't give me a specific reason. It could also be because the FBI may have access to resources that the police might not.
Hold on. So I did a quick Google search, and the AI overview said that they got involved in the case by creating a VICAP for her. So they were working as a coordinating agency.
Okay, so they were helping out with the police.
Yeah, but this is the thing. So, like, so if you said that the police thought that she was drunk or whatever, or she was missing or committed suicide, but the FBI is setting up a VICAP, which is a violent criminal apprehension profile. So, you know, maybe it was the family that was saying got them involved because they're claiming that it had to have been foul play, or
yeah, and I do go on this. I do go into this a little bit later. The violent criminal apprehension profile, or VICAP, that is, it sounds like, oh, she was a bad person. Not necessarily, because yeah, like violent criminals are put into that database. But this database allows them to easily share This database allows them to easily share information regarding her case between law enforcement agencies. So they use that. Doesn't necessarily mean she's a criminal and or violent, but it makes it way easier for whoever's looking at that to get access to it, whether it be the FBI, another form of the government, the police in New Hampshire, the police in Vermont, Rhode Island, wherever.
Okay, so I misunderstood what that meant about the VICAP thing, because like I wasn't thinking that they created one for her. I thought that meant that they created something for somebody, like if they created a profile for someone who would have taken her or something, right? So like you cleared that up though. So like I see what you're saying. They used that particular system so that they could have her information in like a shareable database for the other law enforcement agencies to use. But still, they said they made this VICAP for her 18 years afterward.
Yeah, I go on later to say it was January 2022 that this happened, that they made this specific profile. So they may have spent still helping around this time. And I mean,
yeah, sorry, I jumped ahead a little bit, I guess.
I forgive you. It's okay. Now, where the heck was I? Okay. So New Hampshire Fish and Game, they conducted another search using tracking dogs, cadaver dogs, thermal imaging cameras. And I did want to touch on, I did want to touch on this because I saw a couple of sources where people were arguing about why were they using tracking dogs and cadaver dogs. That's just because those dogs are trained differently. Like, you're probably not going to have a tracking dog that also searches for cadavers, because they're trained usually, they're trained differently with different scents. So they were, to me, they were looking for both. They may not have been hoping for the cadaver dog to hit, but they had both types of dogs out just in case. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so that, you know, they're covering their bases, like if she's dead or not, you know, the two different types of dogs can cover the whole spectrum of missing person or dead person.
Right, you got it. Now, my sister, in a search, she found a pair of ripped women's underwear on a secluded trail, but DNA later found that they were not Mara's. Multiple other searches took place just throughout the years. I mean, they kept searching for her, but nothing turned up. Fred Murray even petitioned New Hampshire Governor Craig Benson, and Fred also appeared on the Montel Williams show. Even after his family returned home, this broke my heart. Fred came back every weekend to look for his daughter until April, when police told him they were getting multiple complaints of him trespassing.
Okay. Fuck your land.
So that's how, honestly, that's how I felt too. And then we had another case where Bryce explained, like, some people won't allow investigations on their land. And I kind of get it in this situation, because some people have, like, you know, maybe you're a farmer and you have crops and you don't want a search team coming and trampling through your crops. I don't know. Maybe you grow weed illegally and you didn't want them seeing it. There's a lot of different reasons why people wouldn't necessarily want other people to search on their property. I can't say that I would tell them no. Like, we live on what, a fraction of an acre? Go for it. Just go look.
An acre at most.
Oh, we're nowhere near an acre. I think we're like 0.3. But yeah, if it were me, like, please go try to find this missing person. But whatever. In late 2004, a man was said to have given Fred a rusty stained knife that had belonged to his brother. Now, this man's brother had a criminal past, and he and his girlfriend were said to have acted strangely after Mara's disappearance. Several days after Fred was given this knife, this man allegedly scrapped his car. But the man that gave Fred the knife claimed that he had a history of drug use, and he made this story up to receive the reward money. It's
What made what story up?
Made up the story that, hey, this rusty knife come from my brother. This was my brother's rusty knife, and they acted weird after this disappearance. They claim that he made this up just to get the money.
Okay, so there was reward money out for information for what happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's what they said this was about. In 2005, Fred filed suit against several law enforcement agencies under the Freedom of Information Act in an attempt of seeing the files associated with the case. From what I could find, some files were eventually released and some weren't, which is strange because this is a cold case. It's not closed. Every now and then they do put a fresh set of eyes on it, but nothing really of note has been found. In November of 2005, a user named Tom Davies claimed to have seen a black backpack behind a restroom at... Oh, God. I gotta Google this one. Hold on. Pemigewasset. Okay. So he claimed to have seen a black backpack behind a restroom at Pemigewasset Overlook. And this was on a message board dedicated to Mara's case called Not Without Peril. And the Pemigewasset Overlook was about 30 miles east of Woodsville on Route 12. The senior assistant attorney general, Jeffrey Strelzin, said that law enforcement knew of the backpack, but they would not comment on whether or not it was tested. In October of 2006, another two-day search by volunteers ended up at a house about a mile from the crash site, and cadaver dogs were said to have gone bonkers on possible human remains at the site. What's notable is the house was previously said to have been the house of the man implicated by his brother who gave Fred the knife.
Weird coincidence.
Mm-hmm. A sample of the carpet in the house was tested, but results were never released. In February 2009, Jeffrey Strelzin said that the investigation was still active, and this is a quote, "We don't know if Mara is a victim, but the state is treating it as a potential homicide. It may be a missing persons case, but it's being handled as a criminal investigation," which is refreshing to hear 5 years after this happened.
Good.
On the 10th anniversary of Mara Murray's disappearance in February of 2004, Strelzin stated that they haven't had any credible sightings of Mara since the night she disappeared. Fred was reported as believing Mara was dead and had been abducted the night she went missing. In February of 2019, which was the 15th anniversary, Fred again told the media that he believed Mara was dead, and he hinted that he suspected it may have happened at the house the cadaver dogs reacted to by saying, "That's my daughter, I do believe."
But 2 years later, though, I mean, like, cadaver dogs still hit on... Like, 2 years seems like a long time.
Oh, they can hit. They can... It kind of depends on, like, how... Like, you know, whether it's inside, outside, stuff like that. But yeah, they can hit a long time. They can smell that stuff. And I just Googled it, the AI overview. Cadaver dogs can detect the scent of decomposing human remains, even those that are decades old. And they're trained to identify the specific chemical compounds released during decomp. So they can detect those remains, whether they are hours or several decades old. Which is just crazy. Dogs for the win. Now, that house, the previous owners of that house, they refused to allow an investigation. I don't know why. But when it was sold, the new owners did allow several searches, but the excavation resulted in nothing being found other than what seemed to be either a piece of pottery or old piping. So they were eventually able to search that place, but they couldn't find anything where the dogs hit, which is still really interesting to me.
Like, what did they hit, and maybe somebody moved it?
It could be. If they moved it, they would still they would still hit on the in that area because, you know, that scent is going to be in the ground or in the floor or wherever it's going to be. But that's a very specific, like I just read, that's a very specific scent. So what were they hitting on? And it's, they do mess up, you know, they're not perfect, but it's still just, that's still just strange to me. So there was a blue tree where Amara was last, I'm sorry, the tree's not blue. There was a tree with a blue ribbon where Amara was last seen, and this acted as a memorial, and that tree was cut down in 2021. I do have a picture of it in the drive. You can barely see it, but the tree's on the left-hand side. You can see it in the snowbank.
Why was it cut down?
It was cut down by the owner. Again, unclear why. The Murrays did petition to have a New Hampshire historical marker placed, and that petition was denied. Bone fragments were found on Loon Mountain, about 25 miles from the crash site in September of 2021. And these were tiny, tiny fragments. They were still tested, but DNA said that they were not Maura. In January of 2022, this is when the FBI issued that national alert and created the VICAP profile for Maura. And finally, in February of 2024, New Hampshire officials released an age progression photo of Maura on the 20th anniversary of her disappearance. According to FBI's missing persons page dedicated to Maura, she has light brown hair, green or blue eyes. She was 5'7", 120 to 125 pounds. She had dimples on both cheeks. She has crowns and or fillings. If you have any information on Maura, please call your local FBI office or the nearest American embassy or consulate. And you can also submit a tip anonymously at FBI.gov. And that's the very frustrating story of the disappearance of Maura Murray.
Huh.
That's all, after all that?
I mean, I don't know what to say. There's just, feels like a lot of, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to be a behavioral analyst or profiler or anything. It just doesn't make sense. And I mean, so no sign of struggle at the scene had to meant that she trusted whoever it was that she got into another vehicle with. There were no footprints. It had to have been a vehicle because that's the only way they would have got away without leaving any kind of discernible trace. So it had to be someone that she trusted. If the other person was saying that it looked like a cop car, then maybe it was someone impersonating a cop, which means that this person, if this is indeed what happened, this person could have been doing this for a long time after that.
Oh.
What? Did you not think of that?
I didn't mention it, but that is a good, somebody possibly impersonating a police officer.
And that's the only thing that makes sense. If the person, unless the lady that reported that she saw the cop car nose to nose with her car was mistaken on the time that happened, that's the only thing that makes sense to me, is that someone impersonating a cop or a cop picked her up and that was the last person to see her.
The only question I have about that is, like, when that woman passed by and said that she's, you know, she saw the nose to nose or hood to hood or whatever, she didn't see anybody. She didn't see anybody outside or inside either one of those cars. So where were they?
I mean, they could have just been on the other side of the car. Who knows?
I mean, maybe, but if she stopped, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe she didn't get out. Maybe she wasn't, like, looking under the vehicles or anything like that.
But did her report explicitly say that she stopped, or she just drove by and happened to see them?
It said that she drove by and stopped for a minute. But when she didn't see anybody, she kept going.
Could have been that she ran up on when, hypothetically, if there's an abduction happening, she drove up as this person was putting her in the back seat or something, and he just laid down.
Yeah, that's what, honestly, that's
I'm
exactly.
I'm making the assumption that it's a he, but, like, I feel like it's a fair assumption, hypothetically.
No, I feel like that's a fair assumption, and, like, your assumption that it's a he. I mean, if we're just going off of statistics, it's more likely to be a he.
And I'm just a dumb mechanic. Surely police probably thought about stuff like this, you know, and tried to follow up on it. But I mean, surely.
I can only hope. I really hope that they didn't mess up and just lose precious time by just. Because it kind of feels like they were just like, oh, no one here. Tow the car. Let's go home, boys. There are some photos in the drive of Mara, the tree, like I said, that memorialized where she was last seen. The last, I guess, verified sight of her, I don't really know how to word it, but where she, it's a picture of where she withdrew money on the ATM. There's photos of her car, and there is the A's Progress photo as well. And that's my story on Mara Murray.
Do you do a lot of stories like this that have no ending?
By have no ending, do you mean unsolved?
Yes.
No, not really. We don't do a whole lot of these because they're very frustrating.
Yeah, very, very frustrating. There's like telling a story with no end. It's like waiting for George R. R. Martin to finish the next fucking book.
Well, see, that's why we do true crime first, because then you swoop in with your paranormal and it's kind of like the palate cleanser.
Sure. Palate cleanser.
So are you ready? Do you want to tell us a story?
Sure. So we're going to get into a little Eastern European folklore, Slavic in origin, especially in Russia, Poland, and Ukraine. The haggard old woman that goes by the name of Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga. A lot of people probably, a lot of people, pop culture-wise these days, a lot of people probably will instantly recognize Baba Yaga as what they call John Wick in the John Wick movies. Let me just get this out of the way quickly. It's not accurate to what Baba Yaga actually is. So in the John Wick movies, Baba Yaga, they kind of like say the Russian boogeyman, which is, that's not really what Baba Yaga is. Like it rolls off the tongue. It's kind of cool, the whole idea, Russian boogeyman, that's John Wick or whatever. But in reality, Baba Yaga is a woman, often portrayed as a haggard old woman. And depending on how you want to interpret it, or what timeline you're living in, I guess, Baba Yaga means different things. So, like I said, Baba Yaga is usually portrayed as a haggard old woman, oftentimes with iron or bone legs.
Iron or bone?
Yeah. So I guess her legs are either like bare bone legs or they're made of iron.
I would prefer the iron, I think.
I don't know. The steel leg seems dangerous. But anyway, so we can get a little into the etymology of the word. Baba is generally just a Slavic word for grandmother or old woman. So, and Yaga, there's a little bit of contention on what Yaga actually means. It seems like kind of the consensus is that it's usually a word associated with like horror or illness or disease or maybe just wicked woman or snake.
So not a good word.
Yeah. So it's just really, it's a gam gam bad woman.
You know, bad gam gam.
Bad gam gam. That's what Baba Yaga is. Bad gam gam. So anyway, she's normally portrayed as having a long nose, and iron teeth and wild white hair. So I don't really know what the significance or symbolism of iron is in this case, like iron legs or whatever, and now iron teeth. Sometimes also portrayed as having only one tooth, but I don't know. Iron teeth seems cooler.
Yeah.
She's often depicted as emaciated, so very skinny, but also described as incredibly strong, sometimes being described as having the strength of many men.
Okay. So she's very skinny because she only has one tooth, so she can't chew. So she's probably on like a liquid diet.
Yeah, sure. Children's blood or something.
Ah, makes sense.
But she's often described as such. And she's very heavily, I'm saying a lot. She's very heavily associated with witchcraft or the sort. So I'm getting into a little origin stuff. Particularly, this is where we get into some kind of interpretive stuff here. So like Baba Yaga probably has existed for a very long time in Slavic folklore. I think the first known, if I'm remembering this correctly, like the first known, written records of anything about Baba Yaga first showed up in like the 17th century, but oral records or oral reporting of Baba Yaga probably far, far outdated that, like possibly 9th, 10th century origins for this kind of story.
Holy crap.
So it's very, very old with roots in Slavic paganism and shamanism. And it's pretty, I think it's pretty widely regarded that Baba Yaga may have evolved from, like ancient earth goddess figures or forest spirits. She lives in the forest, which in Slavic folklore is often like kind of the symbolism for the in-between life and death kind of thing, right? So you walk into the forest to traverse life into death. Which leads some to believe that maybe she was a gatekeeper to the spirit realm. And over time, as Christianity spread through the Slavic regions, Baba Yaga's image darkened to become more wicked and demonic, which is pretty typical, I think, for folklore that's being assimilated into, you know, I think it's pretty par for the course that when Christianity spreads, it kind of assimilates some of these stories and turns them into darker versions of themselves.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And during that time, as Christianity was spreading through the Slavic region, she went from more of a neutral or dual-natured forest spirit into a more like witch, like, you know, like a bad guy. You know, like, I think a lot of people, when they hear Baba Yaga, that's the first thing they think. It's like, oh, that's an evil spirit or a malevolent spirit or whatever. But oftentimes in the stories, she's never really represented that way. You know, in old stories, like she, so in the little bit of reading that I had time to do for this.
Sorry.
A lot of the stories that Baba Yaga is in, that I've found, she's mostly kind of like just a powerful spirit that likes challenging people. She enjoys, people who are humble or can complete her challenges. Some of the famous stories involve another Russian folklore figure called Ivan Tsarevich. Ivan Tsarevich is literally like just there's a whole bunch of different stories of this person. But Tsarevich literally is just a placeholder name. It literally just means Prince Ivan, but it comes up a bunch of different ways. Like typically Ivan is the third son, either of peasants or is the third son of royalty with two cruel older brothers or whatever, but it always follows the same kind of storyline, which is the hero's journey. I don't know if you are familiar with the hero's journey.
I am not, no.
So the hero's journey is a storytelling trope, or a narrative structure. And so, and it's, or an archetype. that describes a hero's adventure and transformation. Like, if you recall, like, something like, you know, even if you're thinking about, like, Hercules, the Disney version of Hercules, that's, like, a very classic hero's journey.
Okay, so it's literally the hero's journey.
Yeah, it's really what it is. So you have you have the call to adventure, the refusal to meet that call, and then meeting your mentor, and then crossing the threshold into becoming a hero. Your test, the test that you have to pass, the allies that you make, the enemies that you make, and then the big ordeal, and then the reward, and the road back, and the return to home.
Oh, well, when you put it like that, I know exactly what that is.
Yeah, it's a circular structure. typically ends where it begins, right? So, like, but it's so Ivan Tsarevich or Ivan the Fool in Russian culture or Russian or Slavic folklore is often that kind of story, the hero's journey. Okay. And in particular, there are certain stories where Ivan Tsarevich, is married to a warrior princess named Maria Morevna, who gets kidnapped by an immortal being called Koshei the Deathless, who he is often pitted against in these folklores. And basically what happens is that, you know, his wife gets kidnapped, and he tries to rescue his wife, but Koshei's horse is always faster. And eventually Koshei defeats Ivan, chops him up and throws him away, but he is revived somehow.
I was about to say, holy crap, the good guy never dies.
Well, he's revived. This was his challenge, you know. This was the but he was revived and then beseeches the help of Baba Yaga. I'm unclear on what kind of challenge she gave him or if it was because he was humble in his approach, but Baba Yaga allowed him to use her magical horse, which is faster than any other horse. And that's how he was able to use that horse to save his wife and finally defeat Koshei the Deathless. So anyway, so some of these stories about Baba Yaga, you know, like you hear things about eating children or whatever, but like this classic folklore is more like a neutral deity that's willing to help the hero kind of thing.
Okay, so I've always heard that she's just like an evil person. I didn't know that this background.
That's always what I've heard too, is just like a malevolent witch, you know, just rolling around in a mortar and pestle, sweeping up her tracks with her broom and just like, you know, sacrificing children. But in reality, she's more of a representation of nature, which is probably why eventually the story gets twisted a little bit, because I guess Christianity didn't look kindly on representations of nature like that, because nature is wild and unpredictable and powerful. I don't feel like I have this very organized, but it's fine.
this was, like we said, very, very last minute. So,
but we can get into some other things. Like, there's some quirks about this witch lady, right? So I mentioned it just a second ago, but like how in like traditional, maybe not traditional, but like the stereotypical like Western idea of a witch is they like, you know, the Halloween version of a witch is they fly around on a broom or whatever. Well, Baba Yaga does not fly on a broom. Baba Yaga flies around in a mortar, steering that mortar with a pestle and sweeping away her tracks with a broom.
Okay. I know we talked about this, but I don't understand I guess with witches, a mortar and pestle makes sense. But if you're flying, why are you sweeping it away with a broom? What is there to sweep away?
I don't know. Like, maybe she's hitting the ground some too, or leaving a trail. I don't know. But that's what it is sweeping away the tracks with the broom. I don't really interesting.
Okay, so she's a bad driver.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, she's just dragging the ground all the time. Bad flyer. You know, don't give her her license.
Okay.
But also, like, what do you think about when you think about a mortar and pestle?
I think of an alchemist.
No, I'm not talking about, like, occupational wise. I'm talking about the object itself.
I think of a stone bowl with the stone, like.
Yeah, like handheld, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this would be like a very large mortar and pestle. And based on like some of the images that I've seen around like on Wikipedia and stuff, the mortar is not really stone. It's like made of wood. It's like a very large wooden, like very large. And then the pestle would be also a very large object. And I read somewhere that pestles could be used as weapons. So that's probably her deal, is that the pestle is not only is a steering implement for the mortar, but also a weapon to hit you with.
Well, I'm glad it's not stone.
Yeah. So, there's also another little silly, goofy, quirky thing that she does, is that she lives in this hut in the woods, and this hut, it is supported on top of chicken legs.
There's nothing I want more in my life than to make this hut.
I don't know. It's I don't think so. Because the hut constantly spins. These chicken legs are just constantly spinning this house the entire time. Apparently there's some kind of passphrase. I don't know how accurate this is, but apparently if you utter the phrase, turn your back to the forest, your front to me, the house stops spinning.
Temporarily?
Sure. I don't know.
Because if it's constantly spinning while she's inside, that sounds horrible.
She's a witch.
So what? She just doesn't get motion sickness?
I guess not. That's probably what the mortar and pestle is for, what does that drama mean?
Well, that's probably why she can't drive.
Just crushing it up and just going to town.
That's probably why she can't drive. She's constantly drunk and dizzy.
On Dramamine?
No, on spinning chicken leg house.
Spinning around, yeah. It's like toddler drunk. and apparently this house acts like a living being, just kind of has a mind of its own, and is also surrounded by a fence made of bones topped with skulls.
Perfect.
Yeah, just classic villain stuff.
You know, actually, I talked to your brothers. We're going to put that in. We're going to put that around the house next year.
Oh, yeah. Just skulls and bones.
Yeah. Perfect. I just got to acquire some, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, already know a witch lives here. No, I'm just kidding.
Nobody will ever come try to sell us internet again.
So this next little bullet point I have, this changes depending on different accounts, right? So it's said that she has magical servants, and it's generally in groups of three, right? So some stories say that she has three pairs of disembodied hands that serve her. Other stories say, goodness gracious. So I saw this somewhere, and I'm trying to find it again. So there was something else, too. Like, there was... It's always in groups of three, like just these servants that she has.
Mm-hmm.
And in, for example, the Ivan story, she has three helpers. One of which would have been the magical horse. In the Ivan Tsarevich story, it was a lion, a bird, and a magical horse that belonged to her. And then in other stories, it's three horsemen, which I cannot remember where I had that. I just had this thing. But this is one of the other.
Can you control F?
No, because I have a whole bunch of different pages open. Man, I really thought this one was cool because in other works or stories had three horsemen that were her helpers, and these helpers were named.
Oh.
Or at the very least, they were colored, and they represented certain things. It was like, oh, it's right here in the notes. I mean, I'm a dumbass. So in some tales, she has three mysterious riders that she commands, a white horseman, a red horseman, and a black horseman, which represent dawn, sun, and night. So, which is suggestive of Baba Yaga being a cosmic being or being aligned with natural cycles, right? So, like, even more
nature
aligned stuff.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool. Just like this idea, I don't know, there's this whole theme of three, like there's different versions of it, but it's always three.
Which isn't that another Christianity thing?
Well, I guess so. If you think about like Catholicism, I guess the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, but I don't know if that necessarily like originated or was part of assimilation into Christianity or not. Like, it's just, it seems like the stories are always three. So I went a little out of order here too, because like there's a couple other more famous tales about Baba Yaga. One is called Vasilisa the Beautiful.
Okay.
And in this story, Vasilisa is sent into the woods by her wicked stepmother to fetch fire from Baba Yaga. So I guess, fuck you, mom, that's kind of mean. You know, go to the witch's house and get some wood. Baba Yaga threatens to eat her, but is impressed by Vasilisa's humility and hard work. So I guess, you know, Baba Yaga puts her to work. And she doesn't complain. And, you know, bad grandma loves that shit.
Yeah.
And in return for doing the work and being humble, Baba Yaga gives Vasilisa a skull lantern full of fire. And later, that skull lantern full of fire burns her stepmother and stepsisters to ash. Happy ending.
Happy ending, question mark?
Happy ending. Vasilisa's stepmom was a bitch.
Oh, okay.
So remember, she sent her to the witch to fetch fire in the first place.
Yeah, but now she's an orphan.
That's probably better than having your mom send you on a death mission. So, Cinderella type story, but with a little twist at the end. Skull lantern type of twist.
Okay.
Reinforces this idea to me anyway, that Baba Yaga is not really like a malevolent spirit, but is more of a neutral kind of thing, because she threatens to eat her, but is then impressed by hard work and humility, you know, and acts as kind of a test and a guide, right? Like, she doesn't help out of kindness, but because Vasilisa proves herself to be worthy. Like, I feel like if Baba Yaga was evil, she would have just threatened to eat her and then done it.
Okay, yeah, that's
true. Then we talked a little bit about Ivan before. Ivan is, like I said, often appears in different Russian fairy tales. And in some stories, sometimes Baba Yaga tries to eat him, and other times she tests him and gives him magical help, like with the horse. And apparently sometimes Baba Yaga has sisters or daughters.
Okay.
I have no more information about her sisters or daughters, but I imagine they're probably just as powerful or weird or creepy. So there are some more modern interpretations of Baba Yaga now. Like, some people see some scholars view her as a symbol of female power, especially older women's power.
Oh,
which is which is often, you know, it's often like demonized or maybe just not even thought of, to be honest, like, you know, misogyny.
Yeah.
So, which, let's face it, that was a problem in Christianity for a long time too. The idea of female power, you know,
Yeah.
And then their other scholars see her as a Yumian shadow figure, which represents the darker parts of ourselves that must be confronted and integrated. So if you, I don't know if you're familiar with what a Yumian archetype is.
No, I was going to ask, actually.
Okay, so Jungian archetypes are, it's a concept from psychology, and like it's like basically like a group consciousness kind of thing, like these ideas that are universal, right? So some examples of like these Jungian archetypes are things like the mother, or the child, or the trickster, or the flood, right? So there's like the flood myth that exists in like so many different cultures or whatever. Like, this is like a Jungian archetype. It's like, there, for some reason, it's like in the collective conscious, these ideas.
Okay.
Right. So, some scholars believe that Baba Yaga is kind of a Jungian archetype, right? But in particular, a shadow figure. So, I talked about the John Wick Baba Yaga thing a little bit. Like, Baba Yaga is not really a boogeyman, I guess, maybe sort of kind of depending on what stories you know, but I still think it's pretty inaccurate because, I mean, John Wick, aka Keanu Reeves, is not a haggard old lady.
I don't know. I've never seen the movie.
He's definitely not a haggard old lady. So Baba Yaga appears in a lot of other more pop culture stuff too. Like Hellboy, apparently she's in the Witcher series, the Witcher series. There's some D&D campaigns that feature Baba Yaga, which I'm not familiar with any of those. And apparently in a ton of Slavic horror games. I'm not familiar with Slavic horror games, but I kind of want to check it out now to see what kind of Baba Yaga horror games are.
I mean, that sounds fun.
So, that's about all I have about Baba Yaga. Sorry, I was so disjointed and all over the place, but that's her, you know, evil witch or misunderstood force of nature. You decide.
I have decided that she is a misunderstood, angry gam-gam. What was it? Angry gam-gam?
Sure. Bad gam-gam.
Yeah, bad gam-gam.
Like Billy Bob Thornton.
Bad Grandpa.
That's Bad Santa. That's Johnny Bad Knoxville Santa. For Bad Grandpa.
Damn it. Okay, well, I've seen both of the movies. At least give me some credit for that. I liked it, though. I did find some pictures and put up there. I don't know. I really am drawn to this house. I have to create it somehow.
You put pictures up somewhere?
Yeah, in the episode.
Okay, yeah, like, so you see what I'm saying, like, I guess sometimes she's depicted as riding, no, she's not even depicted as riding a broom here, but, like, this very first picture, like, that mortar is huge.
Oh, yeah. Wait, the very first picture?
Yaga 9268.
Oh, that's the last one for me. Yeah, it's a huge wooden mortar, just like you said. And it looks like she's, yeah, she still has the broom. But, and then the house is over there on the left too.
But this is one of those things too, right? So like some of these images remind me of like, you know, Hansel and Gretel or whatever. Like maybe this is, it's like another one of those stories that like everybody has.
Yeah. Like everybody has the angry grandma that wants to eat children.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think America has.
No, they just do that in real life.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But no, I love her.
She's interesting. I probably, like, if I had more time, I probably could have gotten way more in depth. There's actually a ton of stuff to read. If you're into that kind of thing, like, listen, chat, or audience, whatever. Look into some Russian folklore. The stuff's pretty cool. There's a lot more than just Baba Yaga. There's a lot of stuff about Ivan the Fool and the Bogatyrs and Tsarevna the Frog and Ivan Zarevich, and Koshe, like there's a lot of interesting stuff to actually look at in Slavic and Russian folklore. Should do it.
Okay, so we're gonna have to add those to our drive so we can come back to all those people at another time, all that folklore. Because I really enjoyed this. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, thank you for listening. If you didn't enjoy this episode, it's probably James's fault.
Yeah.
No, we really do appreciate you stepping in here. I know Bryce does. But yeah, so we'll be back next week. Bryce will be back next week, as far as I know. If not, then sorry about it. But if you want to reach out to us, you know how you can send us an email, you can get to us in Discord. But otherwise, we'll talk to y'all next time. Bye.
Bye.